Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor, here at the tail end of the EU summit in Brussels.
And I'm Colm O'Mungoyne, RTE's deputy foreign editor in Dublin. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses the latest negotiations in Brussels, of which there are many, and the latest politics in London and Dublin.
And it was another stunning week, beginning with the Berko bombshell
and ending with May's humiliation as Brexit is delayed and the EU takes back control.
We'll assess how the week unfolded and we'll hear from a man who was at the centre of 5 years of European crises. How does Herman Van Rompuy's speechwriter feel the EU has handled Brexit?
But first, Tony, another roller coaster week as you describe it. How did it start?
Yes, Colm, well, we thought last week was crazy and weird. This week started even weirder and crazier because, as we remember, on Monday, John Bercow, the flamboyant, colourful Speaker of the House of Commons, suddenly announced at 3:30 in the afternoon that under a parliamentary convention or principle dating back to 1604, the government of the day could not bring back a motion that had already been rejected by the House of Commons. So this rang like a ringing fire bell through the Conservative Party, through Theresa May's government, because the whole point of the proceedings this week was that Theresa May was going to bring back the withdrawal agreement for a third attempt on Tuesday.
A third kicking, exactly, on Tuesday.
And whether or not she won the vote or whether or not the vote got through the House of Commons, she was going to ask the European Union for an extension of Article 50. Article 50, the process by which Britain has been negotiating its departure from the EU. Of course, just to remind people, the previous week, the withdrawal agreement had been badly kicked and beaten, and after that predictable defeat, 149 votes, the House of Commons agreed that no deal should be taken off the table, and they also agreed on a third big vote, lots of amendments around these big votes, of course, as we discussed on the last programme. Theresa May more or less accepted that she would have to ask for an extension to Article 50. And the key thing was it was going to be either a short or a long extension. That was not yet determined. So that was the choreography. Everything was going to according to plan when suddenly John Bercow told the House of Commons that she couldn't actually bring the withdrawal agreement back for a third time because under this principle
because
dating 1604 back to 1604,
says no.
This did really land as a bombshell because you would have thought that Theresa May, who has risked and staked so much of her career and her entire premiership on getting this thing over the line, that somebody would have put a phone call through to the Speaker's office to say, look, are we okay to bring this thing back to the House of Commons next week?
There was a bit of annoyance about the Speaker and shooting it down without any prior phone call coming the other direction as well, though, wasn't there?
Yes, although there had been some to-ing and fro-ing between the Speaker and MPs about the question of this amendment, and I think this issue was raised back in December at a House of Commons committee hearing. I think some of the anoraks who populate those particular hearings had spotted the risk of trying to bring an amendment or a motion back on more than one occasion, and the idea of the House of Commons simply voting for the same issue again. Anyway, this happened on Monday, and that really kind of changed everything because Theresa May was supposed to have the vote the next day on Tuesday or maybe even Wednesday, and then the summit was going to happen on Thursday and Friday. So this was a major bombshell, and it really changed the mood and the atmosphere and again deepened that sense of crisis.
So the summit that you've been attending, we left earlier in the week, or we left last week, with the idea that the June 30th extension was going to be asked for, which was problematic for some quarters in the European Union because it goes beyond the date for making a decision on the European election. The UK could be obliged to take part in that. And in the course of the summit, that date was shot down.
Yeah, so the whole question was what kind of extension would Theresa May ask for and what kind of conditions might the EU attach to that, and how would it all collide with the European Parliament elections. Now, we'll come back to that in a moment because that's a very important issue. But just before we get to the action in the summit, I think the atmosphere in Westminster was extremely fraught and angry after the Burko intervention. Theresa May was said to be furious. Andrea Leadsom was said to be furious as well. She's the leader of the House of Commons. Not a lot of love lost between those two individuals, we're told. But once the idea that Theresa May might be seeking a longer extension began to percolate into the Brexiteers in the cabinet, there was a major revolt on Tuesday in the cabinet. Now, there was apparently eight Brexiteer cabinet ministers who launched a withering attack against Theresa May and this idea of a longer extension, and the whole complication then of the UK somehow having to contest the European Parliament elections. Andrea Leadsom reported to have said that she used to regard this as the cabinet that would deliver Brexit, but now she wasn't sure if that was the case anymore.
Be categorised an optimist in that case.
Absolutely categorised an optimist, because the whole question of delivering Brexit was now becoming extremely fraught. But I think the combination of the Burko intervention and Andrea Leadsom's assault on Theresa May meant that she suddenly turned on the whole question of an extension and dropped the idea of a longer extension. Now, this was quite problematic because, as we've been discussing on the podcast over the last number of months, the whole problem with getting the withdrawal agreement over the line is that there is just no consensus in the House of Commons as to the way forward. But at least if you had an extension, and perhaps a longer extension, you could give the House of Commons time to coalesce around an idea to you'd have this kind of hands across the Commons, you would have some kind of consensual approach. She would perhaps rely on Labour voters, and you could have a different set of variables if you were going to avoid a no-deal scenario. But now Theresa May was taking this off the table, completely saying, no, we're just going to go for a short extension. We've had it with Brexit. The people have had it with Brexit, and there's no way we should be contemplating contesting the European elections when people voted 3 years ago for Brexit. Now, the problem for Theresa May was that while this cabinet meeting was going on Tuesday, David Lidington, who's her de facto deputy, was in Brussels with at a meeting of the European Affairs Ministers, the so-called General Affairs Council, which was preparing the groundwork for the summit. And he was telling his counterparts, we're going to go for a short or a long extension, and that extension could be fungible. This is a new word in the Brexit lexicon.
Fungible.
Nothing to do with mushrooms. This is fungible, meaning that you could ask for a long extension, but if you can do it in a shorter period of time, then it becomes a short extension. You're not necessarily tied to that longer extension. Now, bear in mind, all of this is happening just like over a week away from a hard Brexit. Next Friday is when Brexit was supposed to happen. So obviously the EU was desperate to find out from London as to what kind of extension Theresa May was going to ask for. David Lidington was giving these signals in Brussels, but then in the cabinet, the longer extension idea was being beaten to death by the Brexiteers. And on Tuesday night, Donald Tusk was expecting a letter from Theresa May to set out what kind of extension she was going to ask for at the summit. Officials waited until 10 o'clock, but nothing appeared, and then they went home. Now, the reason no letter appeared was because Theresa May simply couldn't get agreement at cabinet level for a longer extension. So Wednesday morning, the letter did finally arrive, and she basically said she wants a short extension to June the 30th, because she said people are simply have waited long enough and they're not prepared to contest these European elections. Now, the letter had some other stuff in there, which was kind of interesting from an Irish point of view. First of all, the letter made clear that John Bercow, the Speaker, had demanded substantial changes to a motion in order for it to come back to the House of Commons. She made it clear, or she acknowledged rather, that some MPs in London thought that a substantial change would mean a change to the withdrawal agreement, and she kind of acknowledged in the letter that that wasn't ever going to happen. So that was, you know, an awareness on her part that there was no way the EU was suddenly going to reopen
which
the withdrawal agreement.
Which
is progress, absolutely. She was pretty much acknowledging that the EU wouldn't be reopening the withdrawal agreement or the backstop in order to make changes that would be deemed substantial by John Bercow, and that would give her grounds to get the thing back over the line. What she did ask for was that those concessions that she got back in Strasbourg the previous week, do you remember we talked about this, these legally binding assurances
yes.
that she negotiated with Jean-Claude Juncker. The whole idea there was that those legally binding assurances were again contingent on getting the withdrawal agreement over the line. But she was asking the EU now to, well, actually, if you could just adopt those as an EU European Council, adopt those extra add-ons that I got from Jean-Claude Juncker now, ahead of time.
Including the reference to the unilateral statement.
Including the unilateral statement, the joint instrument, the joint statement, these three documents that she managed to negotiate with Jean-Claude Juncker, if they could be bundled in to the to this withdrawal agreement motion, then again, that could make it look different. And she also pointed out that she was bringing forward domestic legislation on the issues of concern around the EU, the UK's internal market. In other words, the DUP's concerns that the backstop would leave them different from the rest of the UK. Work had been ongoing with the DUP to try and convince them to support the deal. And she was referencing this work in the letter to Donald Tusk, that again would be another additional element that she hoped would then substantially alter the complexion, if not the substance, of this withdrawal agreement so that it could then go again back to the House of Commons.
So how did that all go down?
Well, the feeling in Brussels was that this extension idea was extremely legally and politically complex, and it was really going to be up to the heads of government, the 27 leaders, to figure this one out. Now, as you know, and as we've discussed before, ahead of a European Council summit, a lot of the work is pre-cooked by officials and diplomats through this kind of laundering process, so that by the time EU leaders get to Brussels to put a political gloss on what's being agreed, they're not bogged down in detail. Now, the whole question about this extension is intrinsically connected to the European Parliament elections. As we've talked about before, under the treaties, if you're a member state, you have to have European you have to have MEPs.
Now, every citizen has the right to representation in the Parliament according
exactly,
to the treaties.
Yeah.
And if the UK were to be reluctant or try not to engage in the European elections, it would require an amendment to the treaties, which would mean a referendum in Ireland.
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be the sort of more extreme end of the spectrum. But it's pretty clear that if you constituted a the new European Parliament at the beginning of July, and for some reason or other, the UK still wasn't ready, and it said, oh, actually, could we have another extension? Could we go a bit further and stay in a bit longer to sort things out? Then the European Parliament might not be legally constituted, and that could, you know, import a very messy legal and political situation. And when you consider all of the laws and legislation that the European Parliament passes, you know, in a time frame, you know, that does leave the EU wide open to legal challenge, and it's just not something that EU leaders were prepared to take a risk on. So I think the first response from Donald Tusk was, well, if you're going to ask for an extension, it's a risky prospect, and we would like to make sure that you get this deal over the line first, and then we will consider whether or not to grant the extension. So that was the conditionality that Donald Tusk attached to this request.
And how much, I know there's a desire in Europe for Theresa May to pass the withdrawal agreement, but how much actual expectation is there for her to pass it at this stage? I mean, is this designed at any level to be a catalyst to bring about a change of thinking about the terms of the UK's exit from the European Union, or they're thinking about the new relationship with the European Union? Or is there actually a realistic hope, or a real hope in Europe, that she will get this passed?
I would have to say that the hope is fairly forlorn. Now, just talking to officials this afternoon after the summit, what happened was that they went into the summit last night. Theresa May spoke for an hour and 45 minutes. She made her pitch. It didn't go down particularly well. Most leaders came away with the impression that she really did not herself even believe that she could get this thing over the line. They were just trying to read between the lines. They didn't think that she had a clear plan as to what would happen if she didn't get it over the line. A couple of leaders put it at 5% success rate for the potential for the withdrawal agreement to get accepted by the House of Commons.
The Taoiseach others declined said about 10%. To give a number on that, he said he wouldn't.
The Taoiseach declined. Yes, diplomat that he is, he didn't say either way what his best percentile would be. But you know, it's clear that her pitch did not go down very well. So then, the EU27 were left to try and figure out, okay, what are the main issues here? Now, the main issues were obviously what date the extension would be up to, and what how the European Parliament elections would feed into this. Now, as I was explaining there, you would be, again, it would be contrary to the treaties to have the UK in there if they hadn't got MEPs elected. But there was a feeling among the institutions that, okay, look, if it's up to 30th of June, okay, they haven't contested the elections, but as long as they're gone by the end of June, like, what's the big problem? You know, as long as the European Parliament can constitute itself on the 2nd of July, then there shouldn't be a major problem. But I think the view hardened in Brussels, in particular the European Commission. I think Martin Selmayr, the General Secretary of the European Commission, was taking quite a hard line on this. So instead of June the 30th, the date started to shift to May the 22nd, which is the day right before the European elections start. The French were taking quite a hard line. They wanted a fairly strong conditionality attached to any extension. Emmanuel Macron, more or less saying, you know, it's if you don't agree to this, then you're out, no question. Angela Merkel taking a much softer line. The German Chancellor saying, look, you know, history will judge us harshly if we don't do all we can to avoid a hard Brexit. So after 5 hours of talking amongst themselves, and that was after an hour and a half of talking to Theresa May, at about midnight last night, the EU 27 leaders finally agreed a text. Now, what they have agreed was something of a compromise between the kind of more hardline approach by Emmanuel Macron and the more flexible approach by the German Chancellor. First of all, Theresa May's aspiration of June 30th was basically toast. That was out of there very quickly. They just thought that was too risky. So what they agreed then was that She has to go back to the House of Commons next week, try to get the withdrawal agreement over the line. If she succeeds, then she has an extension up to May 22nd to take care of the legislative changes. If she doesn't succeed, what happens then? Well, it gets tricky. So what they decided then was that if she doesn't succeed in that, instead of having next Friday as the crash out date, which puts unnecessary pressure on everybody, they would push it out to April the 12th.
Yeah.
So now that's basically the significance of that date, is that's the last time at which the UK can decide whether or not it's going to have to contest the European election. So they were saying, in effect, you've got until the 12th of April.
Are they in effect saying that? And if you want to stay in longer than that, you've got to contest the European elections, and it has to be a longer extension. Is that implicit in all of that?
Yeah, that's basically the formula. If you reject the treaty, then you've got a couple of weeks to figure out what you want. If you want a hard Brexit crash out, then that's fine. That'll happen by the 12th of April. But if you come up with some other pathway away from a hard Brexit, you have to work that out yourselves and then come to us, the European Council, and we can consider a longer extension. But if it is a longer extension, then of course that overlaps the period of the European elections, and they would have to contest the European elections. So you can see the leverage they're trying to exert there. You guys really don't want to be holding European elections. So why not pass the withdrawal treaty? If you don't, then you're going to really have to work hard to come up with some other ideas, and you need to bring them to us by the 12th of April.
The 12th of April also gives time for indicative votes to be held in the House of Commons. And I heard Hilary Benn, it was his turn to have a failing voice this week. It was Theresa May the previous week, but Hilary Benn had a very sore throat, but he still managed to croak out that they would be putting down amendments on Monday. And it looks like they will be trying, the Labour Party, that is, he's their front bench spokesperson on Brexit. They will be trying to move towards indicative votes.
Yes, so this is where things have shifted quite dramatically in the aftermath of this meeting last night. I mean, again, this was seen as another humiliation for Theresa May. One thing we didn't mention, which we should probably mention, is her Downing Street address on Wednesday night, just before she went to Brussels.
She blamed her fellow MPs for the failure to pass the withdrawal agreement and basically appealing to the people over their heads, which caused huge annoyance.
There was great gnashing of teeth about that, because it seemed that she was blaming MPs for the entire mess that the country was in over Brexit, didn't take a scintilla of responsibility herself for what had happened, and was accused then of kind of feeding into this sort of populist mob mentality, which allegedly is abroad in the UK at the moment, MPs getting death threats and so on, and that she was kind of feeding into that somehow. And her old friend John Bercow, the Speaker, took it upon himself to reassure MPs in the House of Commons the next day that you guys are not traitors, contrary to what some people on social media might say.
He boomed reassuringly.
But I mean, that the whole point was that this had really antagonized the very MPs that she's relying on to get this thing across the line. So, that has really damaged her case. And there is now a lot of talk that, if she doesn't get this vote through next week, then she will be, the knives will be out for her, and she may be gone, which again is going to complicate the whole thing. But anyway, the indicative votes thing would be a pathway away from that. And yes, we've heard talk of Common Market 2.0, which would be a cross-party idea. Now, essentially, that is Norway Plus. It would be in the single market, in the or a customs union or a customs partnership, something like that. But again, that is going to be very hard for the Conservative Party to swallow, because again, being in the single market, like Norway, yes, okay, freedom you've got full access to the single market, but you've got to have freedom of movement. You pay into the EU budget. You're not at the table. Right. And then if you're in a customs union, you don't have your independent trade policy. So, I mean, these would be majorly bitter pills for the Conservatives to have to swallow. But
as if
that's
by
where,
magic
that's where
today,
this is drifting, you know.
Donald Tusk was talking encouragingly about the European free trade area, and he was standing there speaking to the press in front of the flags of Iceland, Norway, Liechtenstein. I'm missing one. Go on. What's the other one?
No, that's it.
That's it.
Well, that's the EEA, which is
the EEA. I beg your pardon.
Yeah. Well, it's basically it combines the European Union and EFTA. Yes, you have Norway, Iceland and Liechtenstein. And there was a prominent tweet from one member state leader, a man by the name of Leo Varadkar, who tweeted very proudly about the meeting with the prime ministers of Liechtenstein, Iceland and Norway, all countries in the single market but not in the EU. Wouldn't that be a great idea? He said. Who was that directed to? Who knows?
Who knows? Indeed. And anyway, he was talking about the customs union at his press conference and how that would obviate the need for the backstop. And but he won't interfere in the Commons. Let's be absolutely clear
yes.
about that. He doesn't want to interfere in the domestic debate of another country, but he
yes,
likes
that's
the customs
right.
union.
Yeah. Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah,
he sure does. Yeah.
So who knows? So this is where these indicative votes are going to be. So I mean, in essence, to cut everything down to its kind of fungible size, we can say that we are now faced with a next Friday the 29th of March, it's just going to be an ordinary day. You know, people will go out and go to the pub and no meteors will hit the earth. But it's just been kicked down the road potentially to the 12th of April and perhaps even before then, because the text from leaders last night was that if the UK does come up with another way out of this crisis that avoids no deal, they need to come to them before April the 12th. So there's talk of another leader summit around the 10th of April. So, you know, the prospect of a no deal cliff edge has just been pushed out a wee bit. So we'll be following this closely. While we're on the subject of crisis, I've been talking to a gentleman called Luc van Middelaar, who has just published a major. He's not a Dutch midfielder, as people might think. He's actually the author of a brand new book called Alarums and Excursions, which is a kind of an insider's look at 5 years of firefighting by the EU, going from the Greek crisis to the Irish bailout to the refugee crisis, terrorism. Luc van Middelaar was a speechwriter for Herman Van Rompuy, the president of the European Council, and he's assembled all his thoughts into this book. Alarums and Excursions apparently is an Elizabethan dramatic term or instruction for actors to prepare themselves for a big piece of action on the stage. This is really his reflections of being in the front row or in the middle of the ring
right.
when Europe was fighting crises all that time. So I've been talking to him about the Brexit crisis and how he feels the EU has handled it, backstop and all. You left just before Brexit was going to happen as a referendum, is that right?
Yeah, I left indeed before the referendum was going to happen, and to that series of crises, I would add the crisis with Russia over Ukraine in 2014, which was also quite a heavy crisis involving a matter of war and peace on the European continent. So from the start, it was very hectic indeed, and in particular, in the period I was there, the Euro crisis, of course, grabbed the headlines almost from the beginning until the end.
So the title of your book is Alarums and Excursions. That is a theatrical direction from Elizabethan times, I think. What's behind the title of the book?
Well, the idea is that it's Alarums and Excursions is indeed the stage direction, which comes right before uproar. It's a kind of battle cry, conveying a sense of imminent action. And it's the very moment in which the actors realize that something is going to happen to them and that they don't know quite yet. And that corresponds to a sense which I try myself to convey in this book, is that the European Union is changing from really a rule-making factory dealing with cucumbers and bananas and all the rest of it, to really a political body which is also dealing with unforeseen circumstances, with with crises and disasters, and which has strangely enough adapted itself to that a bit. It wasn't equipped at all to deal with those matters, but you see a real change in these past 10 years, and the EU today is really a very different one from what it was back then, and also public opinions realize that change.
Now, you make the point in your book that Europe is primarily a peace project, and part of that peace project is to try and detoxify the power of nationalisms, which of course you could argue led to the Second World War, out of which grew the European project as a reaction. And yet, the EU is beset more than ever before by fairly existential threats from outside, perhaps more than ever in its history.
Yeah, and that's why this old approach of what you call detoxifying or depoliticization doesn't really work anymore. That is fine, the approach to smother political passion and transform any conflict, political conflict, into a problem which you can solve technologically or legally. And that worked wonders to build a market within Europe, but it is not the kind of political talent and capacity which you can use if angry neighbors knock on the door, if one member country is facing bankruptcy, or indeed if one country leaves the club, as we now see with Brexit. And I think, and that's what also interests me so much in the Irish border issue. Of course, it's a dramatic issue, but it's also analytically it's fascinating, because why is this whole Brexit story ending, and we're now less than 2 weeks before the initial 29th of March date, with a border issue? Whereas even the Brussels and London insiders at the start of the negotiations thought that it would end with a great battle of the divorce bill at the end, so about money. But the money issues, as you know, have been solved like more than a year ago, and it's still about a border. And in my view, it's not just, let's say, Brexiteers' foolishness to blame for that. It's also that the Brussels machinery is very ill-equipped with the issue of a border. Because this whole idea of depoliticization, of hiding and smothering the politics in rules and expertise, that doesn't work for a border. A border is pure politics. It's like a line between us and them. And the border is pure history.
That's true. And I think that is why it has ended up being the huge preeminent problem in the Brexit negotiations. But it's a bit of both, really, isn't it? Because yes, the border became a hugely political crisis, I think, for the Brexit process. But it was the clash of issues like sovereignty and identity with those more mechanical regulatory things that the EU does very well, like the single market and the customs union. Are you saying that the EU could have been more political in the way it handled the Irish border question?
Yeah, I think the EU could have been more political. Well, the EU itself was also, of course, defending or taking a political stance on this. On the one hand, you have Theresa May saying, I do not want to divide my country over the border issue by having a border in the Irish Sea, basically. And the EU was not having them their cake and eat it too again, and not only because of regulatory issues, but also, let's say, from a fear of survival of the union itself if this market integrity would be come under pressure. On both sides, there was this very strong political position and a real dilemma, so to say. The EU side, of course, realized earlier on that you cannot have everything, and that and you cannot be at the same time in the customs union and have a soft border in Ireland, etc. But the European side has perhaps underestimated also the strategic dimension of this. Because if you say, okay, this is a political issue, it is not only about, let's say, about queuing at the border and rotting fruit in the ports of Rotterdam or and Dublin or penicillin delivery issues, but it's also about what is going to happen with our future relationship with a big neighbor. That would also widen up the perspective. And I think, well, I mean, we don't need to go over all these negotiation issues, but perhaps the Commission and the EU27 accepted a bit too easily and lightheartedly the idea of the backstop. And knowing, of course, that you would end up with a border somewhere. And basically what the negotiating parties ask from that border is to be at the same time visible and invisible. And that's the kind of trick you can sometimes do. And here in Brussels, as you know, Tony, they love legal fixes and fudges and all the rest of it. But you cannot do that with a border, and that they should have seen coming.
Well, what could they have done differently? Because Brexit does pose these fundamental irreconcilable problems, because Britain clearly wanted to pursue Brexit, Theresa May wanted to pursue Brexit, and the economic prize for that was an independent trade policy, meaning she had to be out of the customs union and pretty much the single market to acquiesce to the forces within her party. And yet she wanted to defend what she called her precious union. It sounds like she wanted to have both, but you can't really have both if exactly. If the Commission and if the EU was going to both defend Ireland as a small state and also defend the integrity of the single market.
No, they cannot have both. So, and what the backstop issue is doing now is really, in a way, forcing the UK finally to face these dilemmas, or this trilemma, as some say, two out of three you can have, to look these into the eyes. But it also means for the EU that this is, like you rightly say, irreconcilable. So there's no one solution. And of course, the EU is the stronger negotiating partner, so much the better for Ireland as well. But at some point, you also need to negotiate, or you will have a clash. It's like, otherwise, it's like a religious war where both sides stick to their guns or to their version of the truth, and you will not end up with an agreement. And the withdrawal agreement, of course, in a way, still papers over the differences by using the ploy of delay, which is then seen as a trap by the Brexiteers. And in a way, the fact that the issue is not disappearing again forces both sides, but starting with the UK, where they of course have a lot of work to do to make these choices finally and lay them out to public opinion, and starting in the House of Commons.
So that was Luke Van Middelaar there. He's the author of Alarums and Excursions, his time during a period of crisis that Europe was engaged in over a five-year period, when he was a speechwriter to Herman Van Rompuy. He's actually going to be speaking at the Institute for International and European Affairs, the IIEA, in North Great Georgia Street in Dublin next Tuesday. So that would be worth going to hear, to get his impressions on Brexit. And that brings us neatly to Brexit and the end of this week's Brexit Republic.
Is there anything to look out for in the coming days, or is it pretty much the next big set piece, that summit on the 10th of April?
Well, the big thing to look out for in the next days is, of course, meaningful vote 3. Will Theresa May manage to bring it to the House of Commons next week? Will it be Tuesday or Wednesday, Berko, permitting? How will she fare in that vote? Will it be another hammering? Will she defy all the odds and get it across the line? And if she doesn't get it across the line, what happens next? Is she gone as a prime minister? Will there be a Tory leadership battle? It's all very exciting stuff.
I'm off to Strasbourg next week, so I don't know what if there'll be anything going on there. We'll have to talk about the logistics of how we're going to record this from there, so that'll be a new workaround for us. But anyway,
we'll figure something out. You'll be rubbing shoulders with British MPs who will be possibly at their last ever Strasbourg.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, we might pick up on a few of them. Also,
they may be distraught.
Yeah. Well, if anyone enjoyed this podcast, and I'm sure, of course, you did. Don't forget, RTE's Your Politics podcast is also out on a Friday with Anya Lawler, so that's available from today. But that's it from me, Colm Mumunga, and RTE's deputy foreign editor in Dublin,
and from me, Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor at the tail end of the European Council meeting in Brussels. Thanks for listening.